research job. After 5 years, I started trying to get out of the job, but I didn't get released from being director of research until I had been in that position for 12 years. I was able to do a lot of good for the school in the early days. My connection with the making of diamonds made me known to people everywhere, Army, Navy, National Science Foundation, all the granting agencies, and it helped me get money for others. And I went there with the title Director of Research, and this was for the entire university, not just for the chemistry department, and professor of chemistry. So I was a professor, full professor at 35 years of age, which is not bad. After I finally talked to President Crockett became my boss. I reported directly to Ernest Wilkinson in the early days, but was soon reporting to President Earl C. Crockett, who was in charge of academics. It was very pleasing to me that Earl C. Crockett nominated me and had me give the first annual faculty lecture at BYU, a series which continues to this day. I had the privilege of giving the first one, and men in the administration often compliment me on that lecture as being really top-notch, the best, many of them will say, of any of the ones they've been to. But also, President Crockett had me made a distinguished professor, a title which I hold to this day. There had been one or two other distinguished professors before me. I think the lady who was dean of the College of Family Living for a while, and I've forgotten her name. Yes, Cutler. I believe she was a distinguished professor. What was Sister Cutler's first name? I've forgotten. Yeah, I might have been. And there were some others. I know Anton Romney was one, and Stuart Grohl was one. I don't know whether I was the second one or the third one. I was either the second one or the third one that the university had. And apparently the university doesn't do that anymore. I believe there have only been four. I can only think of four. Cutler, Anton Romney, myself, and Stuart Grohl. And they have either abandoned the program or think that there are not it's hard to believe this, that there aren't any other they want to bestow the title on. Cutler is retired, Romney is retired, so the only active members who hold that title right now are Stuart Grohl and myself. My first office at the university was right in with Harvey Fletcher. He was in the northeast corner on the second floor of the building. After a short while, they cleared the office just south of there, and I had that office. As a matter of fact, they may have cleared two offices. I don't mean south, I mean west of there. I had a part-time secretary, worked half a day in the early days. I had so many secretaries, I don't remember very many of them. Later on, I had a full-time secretary. After a year or two had gone by, Harvey Fletcher didn't want the dean's job, and so they put on a search to find a dean, and the dean they chose was Armin J. Hill, and he just retired last year. But when he became the dean, he didn't want me in that area, and I didn't insist on staying. He took over those offices for his own operation, and I moved to the engineering building upstairs on the second floor, and I guess I was there for, well, I don't know how many years. Then finally, Earl Crockett felt that was not an adequate place for the director of research to be. An office had been vacated, a very fine office over the administration building on the third floor where Wilkinson and Crockett's and the rest of the offices were. and an office that has a window overlooking the quadrangle to the south. The southwest office, there's a big window you can see up in there. That was my office. I think Daniel Ludlow had that before I had. So that was my office. And as time went on, there was more and more work to do, and I asked that I have an assistant, and I asked for Lane Compton. There was some change in his job situation there at the Y. My lifelong friend, Lane Compton, had gone to work to BYU before I had. And I asked for him, and he became my assistant director of research. And then when this helped me work out of the job to have somebody in who knew the work. And then after he was well entrenched in it, then I was able to retire. And he was able to take it over as acting director of research. And a year or so later, they got Leo Vernon to come and be the director of research. It was difficult to get research going at BYU for myself and for others. It hadn't had a tradition in this area, but we struggled with it. I was not very pushy and never have been one to try and push others out to get something for myself. It's been disappointing to me as time goes on and the space that I wanted, other people have, who seemed much less deserving have pushed someone out to take over the space. But finally, Billings Brown, who was chairman of the chemical engineering department. And chemical engineering and chemistry were together at first when I first went there, but then they were separated. I think Billings Brown may have been the first chairman after they were separated. He had a laboratory area, not really too adequate, in the old Harvey Fletcher Engineering Building, the two-story H-shaped structure, as you look at the building from the top. And we fenced off an area with chain-link fence and started our high-pressure work in there. I started to scrounge for war surplus stuff and went after money here and there. And that's the place we worked in for a long, long time. During my last year as director of research, my patents had made a fair amount of money for the university, and I had some money from the National Science Foundation that you could do what you wanted with. And so putting these monies together, I talked, after I saw others get a research facility that I thought much less deserving than our high pressure work, I talked the administration into building a metal building, which is now known as Building B-41, exclusively for high pressure work. I tried to take in many BYU professors throughout the years to work in high pressure, and it never stuck with very many of them. Dwayne Dudley was at the BYU. He was one of my students, but he didn't stick with high-pressure research. His interests were otherwise. In fact, he didn't stick with research. He was more interested in administration. Billings Brown I took in. He didn't stay in the field. Students in chemical engineering have worked with me on and off throughout the years. Kent... Kent Nielsen worked with me for a while. He was in physics and also in religion from time to time. He didn't stay interested. I never could interest any members of the chemistry department, particularly. The first man I interested who stayed with it was J. Dean Barnett. And he still works in the field of high pressure to this day. We have worked on occasion with Smith Broadbent, who is from chemistry. He's had students we've had working. Gerald Bradshaw, we've had students of his. And Rex Goetz and Bevan Ott, Tracy Jr., and one other student of theirs worked with us in the field of high pressure. We've had students from physics. Occasionally, even a student has worked with us from electrical engineering and from geology. We've had a number of visiting professors, some of some importance. The Dean of Science at Rice University in Houston, John Margrave, spent the summer with us. Several Europeans have spent a summer or longer. Some have spent a year with us. I've lost track of all of them. There have been a couple from France, Scotland. No end of people have visited the laboratory. They number in the hundreds. I've lost track of them long ago. Should have kept a log. There is some log, by the way, for the record. I have usually had a calendar on my desk at BYU through the years, and I have saved most of those calendars. And there will be notes on there of appointments I've had. During the years when I had secretarial help of my own, these will be in pretty good order. Where I've been keeping the record the past 7 or 8 years myself, I have, it may not be at all complete. My correspondence used to be rather great, but when I was without a secretary, I have a secretary, a pool secretary over in chemistry department, but so far away and so hard to do it by telephone, I just go type my own letters or don't answer my letters. And as a consequence, through the years, my mail has gone down to about zero, which is what I wanted to happen anyway. But anyway, the number of visitors who have come to our laboratory have been very great. Others that I've helped get started in high pressure, Howard Van Fleet of physics, Daniel Deckard for quite a while, John Gardner, who has now abandoned it. Let's see, Bill Pope of chemical engineering, Dwayne Horton of chemical engineering, Leo Merrow, who is full-time with me, we get his salary on a grant, and John Cannon, who is full-time with me, and we get his salary on a grant. I've had over $1.5 million worth of research grants. Could have got more money if I'd have been aggressive and gone after it. Research grants aren't what they used to be. The reports, proposals have to be so elaborate, and there's so much red tape at the government end and at the BYU end that I become very discouraged with government grants. My plan is to retire from the BYU at the end of the next year. I've got to write a letter and tell them I'm going to do that. I'm going to go into private research on my own. We've written something like, my colleagues and I, somewhere around 90 papers. I have maybe 15 or so U.S. patents and corresponding foreign patents in many countries. If you count all the foreign patents, I probably have maybe 75 patents. I've done some consulting throughout the years. When Tony asked me how I was going to earn a living out there, he sort of presumed I wasn't going to make as much, although I wouldn't tell it to him. I says, oh, I'm going to make lots of extra money consulting. He laughed. He says, you're too young. You're only 35. You can't consult at that age. You need more experience. And he proved to be absolutely wrong. People started to come after me to give talks and consult. And as of some time ago, when I had made a count, maybe 10 years ago or more, I had already consulted for some 50 different organizations, either a university or a company or a government agency. And I made pretty good money at this for a while. I don't really like to consult. I'm not gregarious enough for the job, and it's hard for me to talk to somebody for 8 hours for a couple of days. That's really hard on me, and I've essentially given up consulting. I don't do too much of it these days. It, however, was the thing that enabled us to survive. BYU salary would never have been enough for us to have built a home and done the other things that we've been able to do. We were frugal with our money, saved it, and have been able to advance financially throughout the years because of the start we got by being frugal in our early years. I know I've told the story of how my consulting fee got started, but I don't know that it's been recorded. Maybe I ought to tell that. General Electric wanted me to consult for him and came after me soon after I had arrived in Provo. I went back to Provo, or went back to Detroit, and talked with the man whose name I've forgotten, who was going to head up the Diamond Laboratory and pilot plant and facilities there. And of course, we talked for a long time. I gave many suggestions on their work, all free. They weren't paying me. I think they just paid my way there, but I wasn't getting any money for the trip. But anyway, after talking about what might be done, we had to get down to what salary you're going to be paid. Well, this was completely out of character for me, but I immediately said, how much are you paying Bridgman? Percy Bridgman had been hired by GE as a kind of a front man. He had a Nobel Prize in Physics, which he received in 1948. He'd always tried to make diamonds for a period of almost 50 years, had not succeeded, and GE thought that he would like to come and see how it was done, get him as a consultant. He had not been a consultant for General Electric. He was a consultant for DuPont. Percy Bridgman was so interested that he went to DuPont to get released from his consulting job there so he could consult for GE. They released him and he came and was shown the whole thing. I showed him the belt and how it worked and the diamonds and the whole bit. And Bridgman went around shaking his head. He could see that, well, once you see how a thing done, it's always easy. He could see how he himself could have done it if he'd only been smart enough. Well, the idea was that Bridgman would write an article for Scientific American saying that, yes, indeed, General Electric people had made diamonds, but he would not tell how. GE wanted to keep it a secret. Scientific community didn't like this too well. Vannevar Bush and others complained to Chauncey Guy Suits about saying you made diamonds and not telling how it could be done. Well, Bridgman did write his article saying that these men had indeed, which added some credibility, you see, GE would not have. They say they made diamonds, you're supposed to tell, to be scientifically honest, how you did it. Well, this was second best choice. Just have a Nobel Prize winning scientist attest to the fact that GE had made diamonds, and this he did in a Scientific American article. Well, they choked when I asked him how much Bridgman was making and said, well, we never reveal that kind of information. But I pressed them, which is unusual for me being timid and mild-mannered, particularly in those days. Well, they finally says, well, we're paying him $250 a day. And like that, I said, I'll take $300. They choked again and says, well, we couldn't possibly make that kind of a decision. We'll have to go upstairs and talk to the vice president. So they went and talked to the vice president and quickly came back and says, okay, we'll pay you $300. Well, there was some more talk and this, that, and the other, and then I went home. They wrote up a contract. When I got the contract, it was absolutely unreasonable and wasn't what we had talked at all. They weren't going to supply any money for my research, and yet, no matter who had supplied the money, they wanted all results of any research that I did at Brigham Young University. Well, this was ridiculous. I couldn't sign that kind of a contract. They weren't even going to pay anything for it. And furthermore, they're going to limit me to something like 5 days of consulting a year, which was only $1,500. Well, I needed that $1,500 badly. I discussed the situation with Harvey Fletcher, and he says, no, he'd never sign a contract like that. It wasn't fair. Well, the GE guys were mad at me because they says that there wasn't anything in that contract that I hadn't agreed to verbally before, but they were all dead wrong on that. I can't imagine a company being so stingy to a guy who had done so much for them. They ought to have offered me a $20,000 a year salary for life or something like that. Then I would have gone with them.
Did you tell how much GE was making off of your...
Well, it's estimated that General Electric's sales today of Diamond Grid are $180 million a year. It's their most profitable business, and it takes them into more foreign countries in the world than any other business that General Electric is in. It's a more worldwide universal operation than any other business that they have. I think I got something like $75 for my first consulting job, but after this, which I had, I guess, before I went out to General Electric, But after this, I had an inkling that I did not have before that a consultant was worth a fair amount of money. So that was the price I asked from then on, was $300 a day, and people seemed to gladly pay it.
What happened with GE? Did they make you a new contract?
No, that was just the end.
You never did go consulting?
No, I never consulted for General Electric. Only in an indirect way. I went to South Africa as expert witness for a couple of weeks for a sum of about $14,000. General Electric, at one point, not too many years ago, wanted me to go to Japan as a consultant, and I asked them for $3,000 a day, plus all expenses, and they gladly agreed to pay that, but then I changed my mind. They drug on for, I think, almost a year went by, and by then I decided I didn't want to go, and I told them no when they finally come around to want me to go. But later on, I got to hearing of the fabulous consulting salaries that people get, so I decided to jack mine up a little bit. General Motors came after me to be their consultant, and I asked them for $450 a day, which they very gladly paid. No, I guess that's not how that happened. U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh wanted me to consult for them, and so I just decided, here's a new company, I'll ask them for more and see what happens. I asked $450. And they gladly paid it. Then I called the General Motors people and said, look, I think I've done you all a good I can, and I have another offer, a consulting job. I'd just like to thank you for all you've done, and hope I've done you some good. I'd like to go consult for this other company. They says, well, maybe there's no conflict. How much they paying you? And I says, $450 a day. And they says, well, who is it? And I said, U.S. Steel. And he says, there won't be a conflict. You can consult for us and them, too. We'll pay you $450 a day. So that's the way it went. But through the years, I've taken anything from $50 a day on up to what amounted to a couple of $1,000 a day. That's rare that you get that kind of money. Nowadays, attorneys I use, who I think are not as unique as I am by any means, they get $100 an hour. And I ask $100 an hour nowadays, and if I don't get it, I usually don't take the job. Because if an attorney, if any old attorney anywhere is making $100 a day, an hour, I figure I ought to be worth the same. It's not worth my time if they can't pay me what they're willing to pay an attorney. So I don't do very much consulting. Do a little here and there. I'm currently consulting, trying to help them with a high-pressure project they have going at the University of Dayton in Dayton, Ohio. That's a Catholic university. They pay me, I think, $200 a day, which is very low price for a consultant nowadays. But I don't know. They caught me when I was soft, and the school needed some help, so I give it to them at that rate. I perhaps didn't finish answering question 41 of Shirlene's. 42, what was it like in the Navy? I've told some of those things. Well, Navy life, or any military life, it's something that there has to be, but it tends to be bad because morals are loose when people are away from home, and they swear, it's just war and wartime things are just generally bad kinds of things. I was able to hold up under it, and I think many Latter-day Saint men were. But there's plenty of opportunity and temptation and hard things that you have to close your ears and eyes to and hang on to the straight and narrow in the Navy. I think it's better today. The church is more worldwide and more... it's easier to run into church members nowadays than it was during World War II. The life in anything like the Navy is generally one of wait, wait, wait. I think that's why there's so much idle time. See, what you do in a war is you just wait. And then maybe there's some action, maybe there's not, but it's just a waiting thing. There's so much free time. And sometimes it's difficult to occupy that free time. If you're not a scholarly type, it's a heck of a thing. You've got to be off playing cards or drinking or smoking or or telling stories, and the stories, you know, are unsavory type all the time. Now, I stayed away from those things very well, but it still is a hard thing. If you're an officer, things are the easiest. Now, I only spent a couple of months or so aboard ship, and it stayed in San Francisco Harbor all that time. But as an ensign, which is the lowest kind of an officer in the Navy, I had my own berth, my own little room. Now, the room is designed so that two men could occupy that room, but I had my room all to myself. A Navy officer was considered a gentleman in those days. I had a black man who came and shined my shoes daily. He made my bunk. He cleaned my place up. It was hard for me to get used to that. He would make sure that my clothing was washed and pressed. So you had a personal valet, however you say it, so to speak. And that didn't look quite right to me. Lots of people look forward to that, you know, having servants, somebody who's serving you, doing these things. And the higher you go up in the Navy in those days, the more of those kind of perquisites you would have. And I guess the captain of a ship would have be waited on hand and toe, and have, when he went ashore, on shore leave, he'd probably have fancy cars and all kinds of things. I've had some interesting experiences in the Navy that come to mind as I sort of keep dipping back into things. So I really think I may have told some of those things on an earlier tape. How I was in charge of the entire Pacific Fleet one night for 8 hours. I think I've told that story somewhere. I was the junior officer of the day, but the main officer of the day, he just went to bed. It was during the night shift, and during that night we had some drunken Marines that I had to take care of who crashed onto the Navy base and went through the guard gates to get in, and we had a typhoon with 100-foot waves on the Pacific Ocean, which I had to send out an alert to all ships at sea to beware of that. You have a lot of responsibility. One thing I can say about the armed services, a young man can have the most immense amount of responsibility you can imagine. And, of course, I really felt it that night. Here I had on my shoulders, and the whole sleeping United States did not know that one Tracy Hall was, for practical purposes, in command of the Pacific Fleet for that night. Now, if anything serious had really broken out, I was to awaken the man who really was the officer of the day, a commander, somebody, you know, and get him to solve the problems. But he told me in no uncertain terms, you know, unless the moon came crashing into the earth or some really super disaster, the war breaking out all over again, I was to leave him alone. It was my job until daybreak to handle that situation. This happened while I was at the Navy base there in Oakland. Big Navy base and storage depot in those days. I think the base is still there, but I'm not sure what the functions are. Well, like I say, you can have plenty of responsibility at a very young age in the armed services, and that, if you can survive the bad aspects of being in the armed forces, well, there are many good aspects that can make a man out of you, and it's a good place for many young men to be. I wouldn't knock it, particularly in today's day when the church is so worldwide and you have opportunity to associate with Latter-day Saints almost any place that you might end up being with other people in the armed forces. Looks to me, Charlene, like this is just about at the end of that tape. So, by the way, I think, you know, I have recorded some of the lessons that I used to teach my priests. And I think I've used this event to bring home a point. And if my posterity wants to check into other oral information, I think I've got maybe 20 tapes at home where I have given lessons to the young adult class or to the priest class. Well, I just took my little tiny recorder in and recorded my lessons, primarily to help me be a better teacher. I wanted to see what I was really like as a teacher. And it did improve my teaching to hear myself give these lessons. But there's, I used experiences out of my everyday life all over the place in those, and might want to fish those out someday and transcribe them onto paper via typewriter. Well, Shereen just brought in some ice cream, and this is certainly very, very close to the end of that tape. Mother's in the next room with Charlotte, and she is also telling oral history onto tape on another little cassette recording machine.